From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Tracy Wilkinson, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times, and Jonathan Lande, national security correspondent for Reuters News Agency. Our moderator is the White House correspondent for West Wing Reports, Paul Brandis.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Paul Brandis from West Wing Reports, and these are the issues this week. Protests sweep across Iran. What's going on? Why now? And what could it possibly mean? The Trump administration is freezing security assistance to Pakistan until the country acts against terror networks in its territory, a move that reflects new tensions with Washington and could lead to problems in supplying U.S. troops in neighboring Afghanistan. North and South Korea will hold talks on January the 9th, a glimmer of hope on the dangerous Korean Peninsula. I'm thrilled to have Jonathan Lande here, a deeply experienced reporter in the national security and foreign policy arena. Jonathan, welcome. We're going to start with Iran. These protests that have swept the country, reported in about 80 cities, reports say about two dozen dead, but it's hard to get accurate information. Tell us what's going on.
Well, since there's been a crackdown on the use of social media in Iran, particularly the use of the app Telegram, it's hard to really gauge after a week how extensive these protests are. They do appear to be continuing. There's also been efforts by the security forces, Islamic Revolutionary Guard, the Basiji forces, to try and use the social media to identify people who have been protesting. So there's no doubt that there is a crackdown. Hundreds of people have been arrested, and yet it doesn't seem like at this point that there's any end to these protests. The protests appear to be very different from the last round of anti-government protests, which took place in 2009. The so-called Green Revolution was against alleged vote rigging in the elections for president. This time, very different because it involves or appears to involve large segments of the working class, lower middle classes in Iran, who have been, generally speaking, the bedrock of the Islamic regime there. Expectations were raised for these people in terms of their economic status and unemployment, which is about 40% among the youth, by the nuclear deal and the fact that there were going to be sanctions taken off Iran that were going to lift the economy. This is what they were being told by President Rouhani. Those expectations have not been met. And it's questionable as exactly how these protests began. We know they began in the city of Mashhad. We know that they began over prices. There had been a bunch of price rises, particularly the price of eggs. But the question is, who started them? Now, there had been a leak of the budget. Mr. Rouhani is being blamed for that, of his upcoming budget, which showed that while there were going to be cuts, I believe, raises in basic prices, and cuts in subsidies for fuel, large amounts of money were still going to go to religious foundations and religious schools. And this apparently lays at the heart of what began in Mashhad. There's been reports that hardliners use this as a means of organizing these protests. But whatever the case, these protests spread, as you said, to about 80 cities. There's been violence, close to about two dozen people killed, and we're just going to have to wait to see where this goes. The difference between, one of the major differences between what we see going on now and what we saw in 2009 is that 2009 were sort of the educated elite, middle class in large cities, particularly Tehran. Tehran doesn't seem to really have erupted over this at this point, not in the scale that it did in 2009.
You mentioned, Jonathan, the unemployment rate, about 40%, and about 40% of the population in Iran, I believe, is under the age of 24. The question is, how committed are they to, you know, this revolution that began in 1979? They don't even remember it. They know nothing of it. How committed are they to this theocracy that is Iran today?
Well, you know, again, given the constraints on being able to understand how widespread these are, the fact is that there have been slogans chanted by the crowds against not only the theocratic rule, but against the supreme leader himself, Ayatollah Khamenei. We've heard chants, death to Khamenei. And that is extraordinary. That signals that these economic grievances are fueling political grievances, too, that what began as these protests against higher prices and unemployment have expanded to the political realm. And that is something that augurs badly for the regime.
Tracy, I want to bring you into this a little bit. President Trump has weighed in on this, tweeting his favorite platform, of course, Twitter, tweeting his support for these protesters. Some people have criticized him, saying the U.S. should not meddle in Iran. In your judgment, what should the U.S. do, if anything, about this situation?
Well, it is delicate because sometimes an endorsement from the U.S. is sort of the kiss of death in Iran. It's interesting to see how quickly this administration has come out to support these demonstrations. From the very first protests, even over the holidays, the State Department and then the White House were putting out statements in support. So they've been very eager to support what they see as a dissident movement, even though they may not know very much about it. However, what a lot of people would point out to you is that at the same time, Trump is trying to appear friendly to the protesters, to the Iranian people, as they would say, he has a travel ban in place, or he's trying to put in place travel bans that have prevented Iranians from coming here to visit their families. So, in fact, disproportionately affecting Iranians in the travel ban. So it's a bit, some would say, hypocritical that on the one hand, you're trying to support the people of Iran in their protests, but then you won't let them come here to visit their families.
There's also something quickly that Americans don't think about, but Iranians are very familiar with, and that's the fact that the United States has had a history of meddling in Iran, most notably this 1953 coup, of course, that installed the Shah. So that's something they remember very, very much.
Oh, indeed. And it was the United States that gave refuge to the Shah when he was dying and has tried many times to do anything it could to undermine the Iranian government. So, yeah, that is a memory that I think a lot of Iranians still hold.
All right. Let's move on here to Pakistan, another troubled country. The Trump administration is freezing security assistance to Pakistan. It wants Islamabad to do more to root out terror networks in its own country. Now, the American ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, says, quote, Pakistan has played a double game for years. Tell us about this double game, Tracy.
Well, on the one hand, Pakistan has been an ally to the United States in fighting terrorism, but it is also giving haven to a lot of the terrorist or militant networks. So that's the double game that Haley is talking about and the lies and deceit that Trump has tweeted about, his first tweet of the year. And so on the one hand, especially in the military establishment in the United States, they've seen Pakistan as an important ally that helps support the American presence in Afghanistan. On the other hand, you do see, and Pakistan denies this, but there are a lot of Taliban and other militants who live, and especially the leadership, who live inside Pakistan and then plot from there. So that's the double game.
At the same time, though, Jonathan, it's true that Pakistan itself has been the focus of numerous terror attacks over the years on its own territory. It's struggling with terrorism in ways perhaps that Americans can't fathom. Tell us about that, and how does that complicate this whole issue that Trump seems to have?
So the Pakistani state has basically fertilized extremist groups using Islam as the fuel for decades. The Pakistani military has a strategy of employing proxies to wage asymmetric warfare, both within across the border into India, its number one foe, and in Afghanistan as well, which the Pakistani military see as a ally of their foe, India, which is why they have been for decades giving sanctuary to groups that are fighting against the Afghan government or Afghan governments. And that included the one that was backed by the Soviet Union, that the United States also, the Afghan groups that fought the Soviet-backed government in Afghanistan, it goes back that far. in Afghanistan. The Pakistani military unleashed several years ago a major offensive in the tribal territories of Pakistan, which is where many of these groups, their foot soldiers, have had sanctuary. But they've been very selective in that crackdown, going after Pakistani extremist groups, but basically leaving the quote-unquote good Taliban, the Afghan Taliban, their proxies, alone to continue waging a guerrilla war across the border into Afghanistan, where these groups, both the Afghan Taliban and the Haqqani Network, have not only targeted Afghan security forces, but also U.S.-led international forces, and they've killed hundreds and hundreds of civilians in Afghanistan. The problem is that the United States is in a quandary because Pakistan, A, is a nuclear power. They have nuclear weapons, and they have, going back to the emergence of Pakistan, been aligned with the United States. And so, you know, there have been people within all of the administrations that we've seen since then in the United States that argue we need to stay close. We need to maintain this relationship with the Pakistanis, not just because they have nuclear weapons, but also because they provide crucial intelligence to the United States. They did provide crucial intelligence on groups like Al-Qaeda and others. But that has all broken down. Given the fact that beginning with the Obama administration and now with the Trump administration, their strategies have been to try and use military force in Afghanistan to force the Taliban to the table. That has not worked. And the United States is basically believes, U.S. officials basically believe, that it's because the Pakistanis have not pushed the Taliban to the table.
There are also concerns quite quickly, Tracy, that kind of a China is watching this deteriorating relationship with interest, and there are concerns that Pakistan could be moving closer into the Chinese orbit.
China will always be ready to step in where the Trump administration recedes. And it's important to note that this is happening, the cutoff of aid to Pakistan, as Trump has refocused his Southeast Asia policy, which he now calls Indo-Pacific, to give more emphasis to India. And that is just riling the Pakistanis.
All right. Well, let's pause here for a short break. More issues in the news in just a minute.
This program is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. And a reminder that Issues in the News is available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Tracy Wilkinson, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times, and Jonathan Landay, national security correspondent for Reuters News Agency. Our moderator is Paul Brandis, the White House correspondent for West Wing Reports.
And welcome back. We've talked about two trouble spots so far, Pakistan and Iran. Well, here's another one. North Korea, a tiny country, but we pay close attention to it because, of course, it has nuclear weapons, perhaps about 20, it's believed, and missiles, and a leader who makes incendiary talk about attacking Japan and the United States. But now that leader, Kim Jong-un, has agreed to talks with South Korea. Officials from both countries will meet next week. Tracy, explain what's going on here.
Well, President Moon of South Korea has wanted dialogue with the North since he was elected and has been promoting that. I think what we see is an opportunity because of the Olympic Games to sort of ratchet down tensions a bit. At New Year's, Kim, on the one hand, threatened to, you know, said that he has enough nuclear weapons now to attack the United States, and his button is on his desk. But then Kim went on to say, and I'd like to talk to the South. And Moon responded saying yes. And so they're going to talk next week. They've already opened a long dormant communication channel, a cross-border communication channel, and are already starting to begin to talk. They're talking about the Olympics. North Korea might actually send a delegation to the Olympics that are going to be in South Korea starting next month. And they're going to talk about other issues. And this is making the United States very nervous because although you would think everyone would want people to talk, in fact, the United States is worried that Moon might make too many concessions, that the United States is not going to be controlling the dialogue anymore. And so this has made the administration nervous. But in fact, tensions, at least for now, seem to be easing a bit on the peninsula.
Well, we've seen this movie before, Jonathan. I believe that Kim's father authorized talks in, I think, 1999 or 2000, I believe, which got a lot of attention. Nothing really much came of it. Is anything different now? And tell us what you think the North Koreans want here.
Well, what's different now is that the North Koreans have more nuclear weapons. They have perfecting an intercontinental ballistic missile that they claim is capable of reaching the United States, and that U.S. analysts believe are. The only thing holding them back right now from being able to really make good on the threat that they've made is developing a warhead that can survive reentry. What the North Koreans want, the North Koreans are under increasing pressure from this U.S.-led campaign of sanctions. There's no doubt that they are starting to bite. What Kim Jong-un seems to be looking for is an ability to drive a wedge between the United States, and in particular with Donald Trump responding with as belligerent and warlike threats to Kim as he has made to the United States and South Korea and President Moon. These talks, this opening, many analysts believe is a result of this strategy, this tactic that Kim Jong-un is employing to drive this wedge. What does he want? I think probably what he's looking for is being able to say, with these talks that are going to be held next week on North Korea's participation in the Olympics, in the Winter Olympics, that we can extend these to other talks. We'd like to reopen. There's a joint industrial park on the border that perhaps he'd like to reopen. But if he starts showing that he's willing to maybe make concessions to the South, there'll be less enforcement or easing of the isolation that he's in, and less cooperation with this U.S.-led sanctions offensive.
Tracy, I asked you about China a minute ago with regard to Pakistan. China, of course, is a very important player on the Korean Peninsula. And President Trump has said that China is really the key to solving the crisis on the peninsula. How much can China really do, and how much leverage does the United States really have over China, considering all the other issues that we have with China, like trade and South China Seas and so forth? How much can we really squeeze them?
I think the United States has limited leverage over China. China has enormous leverage over North Korea, but is in a bit of a dilemma. It doesn't want a failed state in North Korea. It fears mass exodus from North Korea into China. So it's only willing to go so far in enforcing the sanctions. Even in the last months of the Obama administration, they had finally gotten China on board with a lot of these sanctions. So China has been verbally supporting the sanctions and has taken many steps, but in the view of this the Trump administration, not enough. Recently, there were reports of oil that is still seeping into North Korea in Chinese ships, or at least allowed by China. And so there's still enforcement that China could do, doesn't do. It doesn't want to completely bring the North Korean government to its knees. And so it's a bit of a dilemma for China, just how far they will go.
And it's because of this the North Koreans just keep on doing what they're doing, knowing that Beijing does not want the Pyongyang to, as you say, be brought to its knees.
Right, exactly. It's interesting to note that just yesterday the Trump administration agreed to postpone joint military exercises that it holds regularly with South Korea. And so that's something North Korea is looking at and saying, aha, you know, we've had some success in their view of getting that delayed. They're going to try to push it until next year, in which case you'd have a suspension for the entire year.
Give me a prediction here, Jonathan. Where is this going to go?
It's really hard to say because we're dealing with very unpredictable leaders on both sides, Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump. Donald Trump has made a commitment to ending North Korea's nuclear weapons program and its intercontinental ballistic missile program, these weapons capable of hitting the United States. I don't know of any analyst anywhere who believes that the North and that Kim Jong-un is willing to do that, is willing to get rid of these weapons, because what they really are all about are regime preservations or tools of preserving his own power. His security blanket. And so where is this going? I think that there's very little chance that we're going to see any really serious improvement in relations. We might see a period of easing of tensions, but the basic problem persists. Kim Jong-un has a nuclear arsenal that can hit the United States. The United States has, the Trump administration has sworn that they will not allow the nuclearization of the Korean Peninsula and to achieve the denuclearization of the peninsula. Those are two absolutely diametrical things, and it's hard to see how that is ever going to be worked out in a way that's going to bring stability and security to the peninsula.
What about you, Tracy? Where do you see this going?
I agree. I mean, as you said, we've seen this movie before. I think there will be talks for a while. Tensions will ease for a while, but eventually the talks will probably collapse because, as Jonathan said, you have two very unpredictable leaders here, neither willing to step down. You hear the administration talking about denuclearization of the peninsula. Well, that horse kind of already left the barn. They have nuclear weapons. I think the United States needs to take a more realistic approach and perhaps talk more about containment and other issues like that. But I don't see... It's just really hard to say where it's going to go. I do think we'll have a temporary period of quiet, but then anything could trigger another upscale in tension.
Is it too simplistic to make this argument? If we could contain a major superpower like the Soviet Union, which we did, of course, for 40, 45 years or so, what's the problem with little tiny North Korea? Why can't we contain them?
It seems like people were following rules back then. And today, it is just so hard to see with this president that the United States has and Kim, who is far more incendiary, I think, even than his father and grandfather. I think those are the difference. The players are different. The rules seem to be, well, what rules are there? I think that's what makes it more difficult. But in theory, yes, you would think that this wouldn't be such a formidable task, but it is.
Now, Jonathan, just in our remaining moments, something that you said that was very interesting about how both Kim, the North Korean leader, and President Trump, the leader here in the United States, are both unstable. In terms of managing a crisis like this, what's the impact of having an American president who's perceived as being that way?
I said unpredictable. Kim is unpredictable. Most analysts that I believe, that I talk to, don't believe that he is unstable, that he is logical, that he is following a strategy. On the other hand, if you look at President Trump and his management and his managers, there seems to be a dysfunction within the administration in terms of their approach of a U.S., a consistent, identifiable U.S. policy towards North Korea and this crisis. On the one hand, you have the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, who talks about unconditional talks, willing to sit down, even talk about the weather with the North Koreans. Immediately, he gets undermined by the President of the United States on Twitter, who says, now is not the time to talk. And, you've heard Trump use these warlike expressions to talk about how we're going to wipe North Korea. We're going to destroy North Korea if it attacks the United States. And then you have his UN ambassador, Nikki Haley, who talks about how they first have to start denuclearizing in order for us to take any talks seriously. And then finally, you have the president of the United States who opposed a dialogue, diplomacy, is now taking credit for the talks that North and South Korea are planning next week. Because as he says, he attributed it to this U.S.-led sanctions offensive that he's unleashed. And so how can any leader take the United States or take the president of the United States seriously as a serious policy maven when he is so mercurial and so all scattershot over his approach to this crisis, but not just this crisis, others that we've seen around the world there and here at home. There just is a total lack of consistency with this president.
Well, that's a whole other show right there. We could talk about that all day long here, but I think we're unfortunately going to have to end it right there. What a great discussion, both of you. Our thanks to Tracy Wilkinson of the Los Angeles Times and Jonathan Lande of Reuters. This program was produced by the Voice of America Current Affairs, our engineer Justin Thwaites. I'm Paul Brandis of West Wing Reports. Thank you very much for listening.